Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by Proliance Energy. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.
Coming up, the Economic Club of Indiana's Luncheon Series, presented by Indiana Public Broadcasting. Richard Chawa is the Vice President of Powertrain Manufacturing at Chrysler. The automaker employs more than 6,000 workers at four plants in Kokomo.
Chrysler's impact on Indiana and its communities is significant, as our presence here generates over $592 million in annual wages, $28 million in paid annual taxes, and, get this, another $150 million in pensions to over 9,400 retirees who live in Indiana.
Chrysler is also building a new plant in Tipton to manufacture more fuel-efficient transmissions. Chrysler executive Michael Chawa speaks to the Economic Club of Indiana next. But first, this news. And now for this month's luncheon speaker. Chrysler executive Michael Chawa spoke to the club in downtown Indianapolis in November. Chawa is a vice president at Chrysler Corporation in charge of the powertrain division. Chrysler currently employs about 6,300 workers at manufacturing facilities in Kokomo. The corporation expects to hire more than 1,000 additional workers at a new facility that will open soon in Tipton. The Economic Club's president, James Mosley, introduces Michael Chawa.
A strong desire to continue improving and being the best at what you do has fueled Richard Chawa's career this summer, recognizing a customer desire for fuel efficiency and convinced that Chrysler's 4.7-liter V8 engine could be even better. His division launched a complete redesign to go those extra miles. This was a $3 billion overall investment in engineering improvements. Richard says it brings the redesigned engine from the cellar to the top of its class. When it comes to Chrysler's Indiana business, Richard is the executive in charge, in charge of many of the company's local interests. Most notably, he is spearheading the new advanced transmission plant recently announced for Tipton County. Born in British Guyana and raised in Canada, Richard graduated from the University of Windsor with a degree in industrial engineering. His career at Chrysler began in 1994 with subsidiary Huntville Electronics. In 1999, he moved to corporate headquarters in Auburn Hills, Michigan, as vice president and general manager of component operations. 2 years later, Richard joined the Powertrain Group. He is looking forward to a fast trip home to Michigan for his older daughter's 12th birthday party tonight. Like each of you, I look forward to hearing his remarks today. If a question occurs to you in the course of them, please jot it down on one of the white cards that you will find on your table and bring it to the podium afterwards, and we will make every attempt to give him a chance to answer it. Please join me now in welcoming our guest speaker, Richard Chawa.
Thank you, Jay. Jay made that comment about me rushing home because he said to me earlier, I only have about an hour and a half to talk here. But good afternoon, everyone. It's my pleasure to be here with you today. I see everyone pretty much got here right on time, despite the changeover from daylight saving time this week. I guess we can thank the Indiana legislature for that, because for many years, as you know, part of Indiana observed daylight savings time while other counties stayed on standard time. And as you know, this was a contentious issue for a long time. Well, let me tell you, I grew up in Canada, as Jay said, where we have something called Newfoundland time. And that's a half hour different than the nearest time zone, so you can figure out how confusing that was. Well, back in 1996, they tell me here, a candidate named Rex Early ran for the governor of Indiana, and he took a real politician stand on the issue. I heard that Early declared, "Some of my friends are for putting all of Indiana on daylight savings time. Some are against it, and some are for it. And I always try to support my friends." Well, like that candidate for governor, I always try to support my friends. And fortunately, I truly feel like I am among friends today, because Chrysler has a long and meaningful history of partnership in this great state. And it's not only important for us, but important for me and about 5,000 other employees that I have in this state. So that's why I'm here today. As some of you know, our most recently announced Chrysler president and co-chairman, Jim Press, booked this speech while still at his former job at the other company. Even though Jim's new schedule prevented him from being here, it was very important for us at Chrysler to keep this commitment. And as some of my counterparts said to me, they had the wrong guy here anyway, because I'm the one that is spending over $540 million in a new plant in this state, and I've already spent over $440 million over the last few years. Of course, Chrysler and Indiana can trace our history back together to the Roaring Twenties. I think that was in Fred Hoffman's time, but in 1924, Walter P. Chrysler introduced the original Chrysler 6 at the New York Auto Show. It featured the first high-compression engine built for an American production car, four-wheel hydraulic brakes, and a host of other advanced features at a modest price. The Chrysler 6 was an instant hit and led to the formation of the Chrysler Corporation. Now, keep in mind that the rate of failure was extremely high in the automotive industry at that time. In fact, 36 automotive companies went out of business that year, while 8 were founded, one of them being Chrysler, and actually the only one that survived of the 8. In 1925, the Dodge Brothers Company purchased the majority of Graham Brothers, Inc., including its plant in Evansville, Indiana. When Chrysler acquired the Dodge Brothers in 1928, the Evansville plant officially came into the Chrysler family, and our relationship with the Hoosier State has grown since then. As I said before, today Chrysler is one of the largest employers in the state of Indiana, with over 5,900 employees at 4 facilities, which include 3 transmission plants and a casting plant in Kokomo. Now, I have to tell you, all my Chrysler co-workers tell me that you haven't lived until you've seen the Bull and Stump in Kokomo, which I have personally visited a few times. Chrysler's impact on Indiana and its communities is significant, as our presence here generates over $592 million in annual wages, $28 million in paid annual taxes, and, get this, another $150 million in pensions to over 9,400 retirees who live in Indiana. Not only do we have activities in Indiana to produce a major economic spinoff from our 113 Chrysler, Dodge, and Jeep dealers and over 330 supplier locations in the state. So you can see that this is a very important state to us. We also have a long history of supporting the communities where we live. And through the Chrysler Foundation, we've supported several community organizations throughout Indiana, including the United Way of Howard County, the Western High School Panther Tech Robotics Team in Rushville, the 100 Black Men of Indianapolis, United Way of Central Indiana, the Kokomo Symphonic Society, the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, and the Community Foundation of Howard County. And last but not least today, I'd like to announce a $20,000 donation to the Keep the Indianapolis Beautiful on behalf of the Chrysler Foundation, and we know the money will be put to good use in Indianapolis. So you can see, not only do we have a great history in Indiana, but as I said, we have a great future, including additional investment, and I'll tell you more about that in a few minutes. To understand how our investments in Indiana fit into Chrysler's strategic direction, it's important to understand a little about the competitive landscape in today's automotive industry, which many of my friends at the podium were asking me about earlier. In many respects, the industry is as tough and unforgiving as it was back in the 1920s, when so many companies came and vanished. The U.S. market is the most open and competitive in the world. And as the automotive industry becomes more global, more and more players are trying to carve out a piece of the business here. You name the country, they all want to play here, whether they be based in Japan, South Korea, and several European countries who already sell here. And as you've all read, we expect the Chinese to try to gain entry sooner than later. American consumers are very receptive to buying foreign brands, which today account for roughly half the market. Turning a profit is not easy with all that competition. At the same time, the overall market trends have been difficult. As many of you know, the soft housing market, combined with the volatility of oil prices, have a real impact on consumer confidence and spending. U.S. housing starts here in September were at a 14-year low, which translates to having a big impact on the contractors who buy our trucks today. So there's an immediate effect right there on one of our most important vehicle segments, which make up over 60% of our mix today. As a result of these factors, auto industry sales are significantly down. Early in the year, U.S. light-duty vehicle sales were running at what we would consider a healthy 17.2 million annualized sales. In October, this rate was barely over 16 million. Another factor facing the industry is that it is heavily regulated. Probably regulated as much as the outside, short of the nuclear power industry, automotive is the most heavily regulated industry. Cars and trucks are a highly visible part of our lives and are a target for regulators in areas like safety, fuel economy, and emissions. Let me touch on a couple of them. Regulatory pressure, shifting consumer trends, and world events and national politics all come together in the current debate over energy security and climate change. The perception is that cars are largely to blame for CO2 emissions and global warming, as you can see evidenced by many of the debates. But the reality is the auto industry's share of CO2 emissions is less than 20%. Chrysler, like most major automakers, including GM, Ford, and Toyota, supports the Hill-Terry bill that would raise U.S. fuel economy by 40% by 2022. 40% better fuel economy. That's a big stretch, but we believe it is realistic. The important part of the Hill-Terry bill is that it keeps separate standards for cars and trucks. Combining the car and truck standards would penalize full-line automakers who build both cars and trucks, and not to mention punishing families and workers who need minivans, SUVs, pickup trucks to haul our kids and work tools or even tow a trailer. Obviously, at this time, we don't believe there is one single approach out there that will solve the energy security and emissions challenge. Instead of counting on one silver bullet, we at Chrysler are taking an approach based on a combination of energy diversity and advanced powertrains. Stepping up our use of biofuels, including biodiesel and ethanol, can provide immediate impact. Chrysler has put over 2 million flex fuel vehicles on the road, capable of running on clean, renewable E85, which is 85% ethanol, and that includes our new Dodge and Chrysler minivans, which some of you might be well aware of, feature over 35 new and improved features, such as our swivel and go seating, making them our family room on wheels. you'll see us bring on more and more flex fuel capable vehicles as we're committed to making 50% of our annual volume flex fuel capable by 2012. Of course, our flex fuel vehicle production won't matter if drivers can't find E85 at their corner gas station. Over the last 2 years, Indiana has gone from zero E85 pumps to 96 today. But, of course, a lot more needs to be done for this to take hold. The development of infrastructure, as well as continued advances in the science of both ethanol and biodiesel production, are needed to bring alternative fuels to their full potential. Chrysler is also developing a variety of technologies to improve fuel economy. You'll see later this month, we'll unveil two hybrid versions of our full-size SUVs, the Dodge Durango and Chrysler Aspen. This will improve fuel economy by 25% without compromising any of the power that is available and torque and the ability to tow trailers. But hybrids alone aren't the answer. We're also expanding our offerings of vehicles with modern clean diesel engines that offer up to 30% increases in fuel economy and 20% reductions in greenhouse emissions, like our new Dodge Ram 2007 model, which has a new 6.7-liter straight-six diesel engine from Cummins, who is our longtime diesel engine supplier based right here in Columbus. It has new emission controls technology that make it the first Chrysler LLC vehicle to meet emission controls in all 50 states 3 years early. We've created a new organization to focus on electric drive and other advanced propulsion technologies. In addition to what Jay said earlier, we're spending $3 billion to bring new powertrains to market, including a new, more fuel-efficient family of V6 engines, lighter axles, and, as I said before, cutting-edge transmissions. Now, as Vice President of Powertrain, this powertrain offensive obviously makes me excited, and I must talk to you a little bit more about that. Now, there you have it, a snapshot of the industry landscape, intense global competition, and pressure on several fronts to reduce gasoline consumption and CO2 emissions. It will require substantial investments, not only to win in this game, but just to stay in the game. And Chrysler is fortunate to have the backing that allows us to do so. As all of you know, in August, Cerberus Capital Management acquired an 80.1% of Chrysler from what was then Daimler Chrysler. Daimler still continues to hold on to 19.9% of Chrysler. As a result of this transaction, Chrysler is the first major North American automaker in 50 years to be privately operated. Now, I'm not here to tell you that the private model is right for every company, but for Chrysler, there are some definite advantages. In addition to their financial expertise, Cerberus has a great operational team made up of over 200 operational experts, industry all-stars called from around the world, including, as some of you know, Indiana's local son, the former Vice President, Dan Quayle. They are invaluable and a unique resource within private equity. To cite just one example that we're now embarking on, we're using their expertise in information technology to strengthen the global capabilities of procurement and supply management that we can leverage worldwide. Another one of the advantages of being private is that we can also operate independent of Wall Street's expectations of quarterly results. In other words, we can keep focus on doing what's right for the long-term health of our business. For example, it's easier for us to dispose of assets such as land holdings and buildings, to generate cash. As a public company, you might not do that if you're not going to recoup your book value, because then you would have to show it up as a loss. Under private ownership, that's simply not a factor. Speed is another asset of private ownership. Cerberus has moved fast in bringing in some of the best talents anywhere. Our chairman, Bob Nardelli, who has a proven track record of success heading up Home Depot and one of the top executives at GE under Jack Welch, was brought in as Chrysler's chairman and CEO. Jim Press, the highly respected president of Toyota Motors North America, was hired as Chrysler chairman and president. And Bob, Jim, and our vice chairman and president, Tom Lasorda, make up what many consider to be the strongest leadership team in our industry. Not to mention other top talent with experience at companies like Lexus, Nissan, and GM have joined during the first 100 days of the new Chrysler. Many of them say they were attracted by the way our leadership under private equity really function as owner-operators of the company. That's another factor in bringing a lot of energy and determination to turn Chrysler into a top performer. Now, at the same time we are facing up to market realities and right-sizing our costs to align with revenues, we're moving fast when it comes to making tough decisions. As we showed last week when we announced that we're eliminating over 1,000 white-collar jobs and up to 10,000 production jobs, in addition, we're phasing out four of our current products. Now, none of these changes that we just announced will have a direct impact on our operations in Indiana, although 2 years ago, we regrettably needed to make a tough but necessary business decision to close the Indy Foundry right here in the city. That closing, along with our more recent reductions, was made to align our costs with the economic conditions we expect. Now, taking a longer-term view, we realize that pushing too many vehicles onto dealers would create a whole set of new problems, as we've learned many times over. Higher incentives, weaker brands, lower residual values, and poor relationships with our dealers has been repeated many times over. Under Cerberus, we are also moving with speed to make our investment decisions. Our current capital spending plan at Chrysler is $3 billion a year. Now, that may sound like a lot of money, but the automotive industry is a capital-intensive business that requires that kind of financial outlay. In fact, to stay competitive, we really have to make that $3 billion in investment do the work of $6 billion. And how do we do that? Let me tell you a couple of ways how we're doing it. One important way we maximize this investment is through what we call flexible manufacturing strategy, which encompasses our plants, tooling, processes, and people. Flexibility allows us to produce a higher quality product faster, but for a lower cost. State-of-the-art robotics is one aspect of flexible manufacturing. In recent years, the evolution of robot hardware and industrial controllers has made robotics more capable and less costly than previous generations. So how did we apply that? To give you one example, our body shop at our Belvedere, Illinois assembly plant is made up entirely of robots that change end effectors, which is basically their hands, if you will, in order to build different models. The 780 robots in the body shop can make tool changes automatically. This gives us the flexibility to currently build three models, our Dodge Caliber, our Jeep Compass, and our Jeep Patriot, with capability to add a fourth model. Our Sterling Heights assembly plant also has a similar state-of-the-art robotic body shop, and that's how we progress and migrate that through all of our plants. Now, why is this flexibility important? Well, for one thing, it allows us to vary production to meet customers' preferences which are continually evolving, so we can mix model depending on what the customer wants. At the same time, this robotic flexibility enables us to quickly and with minimal investment change over to the next generation of models by simply changing software programming and not going through a massive hardware change. Another aspect of our manufacturing strategy involves flexing volume between plants to respond to market demand. As I said before, our Sterling Heights assembly plant currently builds our mid-size Chrysler Sebring and Dodge Avenger models. But it also has the ability to flex to the small vehicles produced at our Belvedere plants, so we can move products between plants. Now, last but not least, a flexible workforce is also essential to maximizing our capital investments. Our so-called smart manufacturing approach uses a team-based work structure with flexible work classifications. Now, many people ask me, what does SMART mean? Because we always think of some acronym of SMART. Well, let me just tell you the history on it. Our powertrain employees in Kokomo, along with our union leadership, as we started to teach this thing, what do you call it, lean manufacturing and everything, the union leader come up and says, this is not really anything new. It's not dumb. So we thought, let's not call it not dumb manufacturing, but SMART. So there's no acronym for it. So in smart manufacturing, smart teams led by hourly workers are empowered to run their areas. They solve their own problems that arise and find ways to continually improve quality and efficiency. Operators have the ownership and accountability to get things done. The main theme is our management's role is to support that operator, which is what they've been telling us for many years. Many of these operators who run the factories are responsible entrepreneurs who run their homes. They work in churches. They work in voluntary. They run small businesses. And we need to unleash their capability as they come into work in our factories also. We have a prime example of flexible work teams at our plant in Dundee, Michigan, that builds our fuel-efficient four-cylinder world engine. Employees have gone through 1,500 hours of orientation and training in the latest practices of lean production and quality. And they bring this knowledge to an environment that encourages operational flexibility. They have also adopted an innovative schedule in which we have three crews that work 4 10-hour straight time shifts per week. So they work 4 days a week, 10 hours a day. That means we get 120 hours of production out of a plant every week compared to traditionally where we would have had 80 hours with a typical production schedule. At the same time, individuals work 49 fewer days per year, giving them more family time. This is another innovative way that we've worked with a flexible operation and people to get the maximum out of our capital spending, but at the same time, giving people more time off. Beyond manufacturing flexibility, partnerships is a key role in making our investment dollars do more. The ability to leverage alliances is an important part of our strategy to transform Chrysler and give it a successful foundation for the long term. An example of partnership is our agreement with Chery Automobile to work together in developing and manufacturing small and subcompact cars that will be distributed globally under Chrysler brands. This agreement will enable us to profitably compete in the small vehicle segments, which today Chrysler does not compete in, but are very critical to the international success and becoming increasingly more important in North America. Now, we realize that recent recalls from China and other industries put into question the quality of Chinese products. And I have been in the forefront of these negotiations. So Chrysler, I can assure you, will not bring in a vehicle into the North American market that does not meet all necessary safety and regulatory requirements. We know we only have one chance to get it right. And we have many examples where it wasn't done right in the past. by other manufacturers who have tried to come into the market. Unless we are entirely confident in the quality of any vehicles produced within this partnership, we will not bring them into this market. We've also partnered with suppliers to develop innovative business models. Our example is the Toledo Supplier Complex, where we build the Jeep Wrangler and the four-door Wrangler Unlimited. Right now, about the hottest vehicle on the planet. We can't make enough of them. Three supplier partners manage and operate major parts of the production process from facilities within the plant's footprint. Magna Steyr operates the paint shop, the Kuka Group builds bodies, and Hyundai Mobis-owned Ohio Module Manufacturing Company assembles the vehicle chassis, and Chrysler puts it all together in the final assembly. This Toledo Supplier Park is the first North American operation to have three major vehicle building operations owned or operated by supplier. This investment by supplier enables Chrysler to optimize our capital dollars to invest in additional products. Last but not least is where we leverage the supplier partnership right here in Indiana. We're teaming up with Getrag, where in June we broke ground in Tipton for a plant that will produce a new fuel-efficient dual-clutch transmission. This is a $530 million investment in a state-of-the-art facility that will employ approximately 1,170 full-time workers and produce 700,000 units annually. Production is slated to begin in 2009, and we also have, supporting that plant, over 230 employees at our casting and other transmission plant that will be dedicated to supplying parts for that plant. Construction, if you have a drive by Tipton, is moving forward as schedule, and we'll be moving into the building next summer. The Tipton plant will make an important contribution to our efforts to improve fuel economy. For some of you, dual clutch transmissions provide better shift quality, better driving comfort, and enhanced fuel efficiency compared to conventional technologies. These transmissions work by using what we call two lubricated clutches, one that engages the second, fourth, and sixth gears, and one that engages the first, third, and fifth gears. The bottom line on that, it results in 5 to 10% fuel economy improvements compared with our conventional automatic transmissions. This is an investment that is a significant step towards realizing our vision to transform Chrysler into a stronger company. And it builds on our already strong relationship with the state of Indiana. So to sum it up, the automotive industry today has its share of challenges, severe competition, considerable regulatory pressure, and the need to address energy and environmental issues. But there is also plenty of opportunity for growth in North America and globally. For a company that is customer-focused, that has a firm and solid strategic plan, and last but not least, an ability to execute it. At Chrysler, I believe we have the leadership to get the job done. And at Chrysler, we know we are part of a unique historical moment, not just for our company, but really for the automotive industry. We know the future is in our own hands to restore our company to greatness. And I'm personally excited to be a part of writing the next chapter in Chrysler's history. Thanks for your attention. It's been my pleasure.
Please bring them forward. I want to start off by asking, Richard, if you could talk a little bit about how smart workers and flexible management connect with the United Auto Workers Union.
Certainly. I can, part of my travels and, as I call it, my day-to-day job is to visit over 12 different manufacturing plants across the country to Brazil and into the Far East. of which I mentioned I have four right here in Indiana. The highlight of my day usually is by the plant presentations, typically, that I attend. Every worker, whether they belong to the UAW or some other affiliation, wants to come in and do a great job. Our job as management is there first and foremost is to support that operator. Either support them from the perspective of removing obstacles, support them in motivation, support them in resources, you name it. And frankly, there's a lot of initial uncertainty, not sure whether or not this is just a program of the day. But as long as we continue to listen, implement, I think that's all everyone asked for. And frankly, the results have been simply outstanding, not only from a quality and productivity perspective, because if you look at productivity ratings of our transmission plants and our powertrain plants as measured by our harbor results, typically we're in the leadership role throughout the industry. So I take my hats off to the people in the plant in Indiana and all over Michigan that they have been leading the way with this thing called SMART, and our job is to not only support them but also get out of the way.
I have several questions asking what makes Indiana attractive for automotive companies and what does Indiana need to do to be an even better location for your plants?
Well, a couple of fronts. Location-wise, it's great because it can support many of our assembly plants in terms of a location geographically where we are. And secondly, the working very closely with the state and local municipalities, they have been very responsive to our needs whenever we've come knocking. And that environment with Fred Hoffman and his team working with the various levels of the government has made it continue to be attractive along with our workforce. So I'd say on a three-pronged effort, we've got good experienced talent base here, the geographic location, and favorable government to work with.
Do you have plans to replace the car's gas tank with a hydrogen fuel cell, and what can you tell us about plug-in electric cars?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, there is no one silver bullet with respect to alternative fuels. Each one of them has various different levels of cost factors. The first one being diesels, the second one being E85, seem to be the most attractive from an economic payback perspective. We are getting into the race with hybrid vehicles, which is a combination of electric and we also do offer smaller cars, which we call our gem cars, which are more your resort-type vehicles that are all truly electric. We do have the capability and technology to offer it, but at this time, the consumer preference in terms of paying for it is not appealing.
With a new advanced transmission plant in Tipton County, what impact will that have on Chrysler facilities nearby, such as in Kokomo?
Overall, obviously, with the new plant, we will be requiring, I think I mentioned, a little bit over 1,100 people that we will be utilizing. Most of the people will come from the three transmission plants that are there. The casting plant is typically fully employed, and any offsets with regard to any attrition or volume reductions, most of the people we believe are going to be utilized. There may be some short-term periods. And again, if we can get this industry turned around where we're at 17, 18 million units, you never know. We can be back into increasing our workforce here.
Have you had time working with new President Jim Press and the new ownership of the company to see where the future is for Chrysler?
Certainly, some of the new people or all of the people I mentioned earlier are very engaged, as you might imagine. Jim Press has certainly brought a lot of new insight into our sales and product development organization with respect to dealership communications with our dealership and relationships. We believe he's probably the best in the industry in terms of dealer relationships and also in driving towards what the customer wants, and he brings a lot of that perspective, a fresh eye views to us.
How long do you plan to stay in Indiana?
Well, I said I'm going back home this afternoon. So. But obviously I'm here all the time. Four of my biggest facilities are here. We have over almost 6,000 people here. So I do come and visit the plant quite often, and as much as they want me.
Well, I'm encouraged to offer you a suggestion to return often and stay as long as you'd like. And a final question, what do you see about the overall economic impact of biofuel on other areas of the economy in addition to the automotive industry?
Well, I think it has a great opportunity. Obviously, with biofuels, as I mentioned earlier, by the 2010, we'll have over 50% of our vehicles capable of biofuels and E85 capable. So I'm looking forward to seeing the infrastructure and perhaps some form of incentives to promote more biofuels and access to it, because we believe it's one of the alternatives that's out there for different alternative fuels, and also there would be less dependence on foreign oil. And hopefully that infrastructure will spawn its own industry. So together I think it's an opportunity out there, and it can also help everything that we're doing with respect to offering alternative fuels that people will not have to pay a penalty for going towards the different alternative fuels.
Please join me in thanking Mr. Chawla for your insights today and what you're doing for our state.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to another in a series of luncheon speakers at the Economic Club of Indiana. The next speaker is Indiana University President James McRobbie. McRobbie will address the club on December 18th about the university's commitment to Indiana. Thanks for joining us for this Indiana Public Broadcasting series of luncheons from the Economic Club of Indiana. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana's Luncheon Series. Larry O'Connor is the Executive Director of Butler's Business Accelerators. He's also one of the members of the Economic Club of Indiana's Executive Committee. In this interview, he shares some of his favorite moments from past Economic Club lunches.
Yes, my name is Larry O'Connor, and I've been involved with the Economic Club for a long time, and I'm currently on the Executive Committee. Well, the Economic Club traces its history back to 1974, and there were actually three individuals, business people in town, who were Penrod members, and David Orr, John Medvekas, and Ted Bohm, who decided, along with a group of others, that Indianapolis needed an economic club similar to the activities in Chicago, Detroit, and California, and so pulled it together, got some top business leaders in town involved. Tom Lake, who was president of Eli Lilly and Company at the time, later chair of Lilly Endowment, was the first president. And the organization was off and running. And I was not involved then, but I became involved not too many years after that. And my memory was incorrect, but I've corrected it with the facts. I thought Milton Friedman was the first speaker at the Economic Club of Indianapolis, but actually it was Elliot Richardson, who was Attorney General at the time, was the first. Milton Friedman was the second, but we got off to a great start, had great attendance, which continues to today, and we've had many, many highlights over the years and continuing today. Well, I remember well Secretary of State George Shultz made a major foreign policy address in April of 1985. And what I remember about it, it was the all-time high attendance, 2,400 people. We were back in the, we occupied the exhibition space in the convention center, just filled it. And it just was an attendance zenith. Since that time, we haven't been there. We did get over 2,000 on one or two other times. But I remember George Shultz walking in, and what an event that was. But we've had a wonderful, renowned group of speakers of all elks, of all kinds, and the audience has stayed with us, and we're constantly reinventing the audience as time goes by. I guess one other memory I remember because it was interesting. William F. Buckley Jr. was the speaker, and he's at the podium, and let it be known that he needed a glass of wine. In fact, he needed a glass of wine, or he really wasn't prepared to speak without a glass of wine. Well, amazingly enough, the convention center staff and the management of the Economic Club got William F. Buckley Jr. a glass of wine, and he gave a marvelous speech, but I remember that. But, you know, the economic speakers from Milton Friedman, John Galbraith, you know, kind of a lot of sides of similar issues have all been exciting. I had the privilege of being president of the club in 2002-2003, and that was a fun year. That was the year we had this planned ahead of time, but Paul Tagliabue, who was then the commissioner of the National Football League, came to town. And I remember it seemed like everybody in Indianapolis was calling me. They had to be at the head table with Paul Tagliabue. And so I tried to test my diplomatic skills. But that was a very memorable talk also, very important at that time in the history of the Indianapolis Colts, which... And since that time, they've soared, not because Paul Tagliabue came to town, but because the management and coaching made them soar. Our next speaker, Jim Rogers, the CEO of Duke Energy, and is the speaker. And, of course, Jim was here in Indianapolis when he came in to be the CEO of Public Service Indiana, and then he's moved on and done extraordinarily well in town, but he's still a great friend of Indiana and a great friend of a lot of people in the Indiana business community. And I know he's been a leader on the power industry in the country, been a major advocate really for the green movement and the environmental lobby, which is great that a CEO in an energy company is taking that position. So I'm sure his conversation with the audience will be exciting. So I hope everybody comes. Yeah, it's amazing. We have 700, 800, 900 people, and I remember again the year I was president, we had Michael Kurgan, who is the Canadian ambassador to the United States, and we're sitting there, and he said, Larry, says, you know, this is the biggest audience I've ever addressed. Well, I felt pretty good. He had to come to Indianapolis to get the type of audience you'd think he'd have as he travels around the country, but I felt good about the club when he said that. Well, I think it's a very natural progression. As we're very much in a regional economy and we're very much in a world economy, we've always tried to have national, international speakers, but we want our reach to be statewide, and certainly we want our reach to be the one-hour drive time, because I think the central Indiana region really is Lafayette, Bloomington, Terre Haute, around to Columbus, Richmond, Muncie, Kokomo, and back around, and that's the primary audience. We'd like to have the northern and southern parts of the state, but certainly we want that group of people, because many of them drive down here many days a week anyway, and we want them to be part of our club.
Larry O'Connor is a member of the Economic Club of Indiana.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.